Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. As you can see, some people can watch this. You know, you can watch this if you want. I'm flying solo this month, so we thought this would be a good time to check in with folks just about what's happening in LRIS world as the pace of things picks up here in the fall, as it always does. And of course, it gives us a little more time to dig into the cases. We have four good ones this month, two on employee speech rights, public employee speech rights, and two on the dreaded prosecutorial immunity, right? So we have, of the four cases, two cases where the good guys win and two cases where they don't. You can figure out which is which after the break. So stick around. It should be fun. Okay, we're back. So first things first, what's going on with LRIS? You know, what's happening? So our seminars and webinars is the answer. In the fall, things usually tend to pick up with seminars, and we've been doing a lot of webinars, and this year is certainly no exception. We have been in Vegas, right, in September. We were there a few weeks ago. We're there again in October. We're there again in November. And then I'm on the road all over speaking to groups. I'm actually flying out to go speak to the FOP Great Lakes Coalition about artificial intelligence and free speech and privacy cases and all that stuff. So it's a real busy time for us, but that's great. 2 weeks ago, we were in Las Vegas for our grievances and technology seminar. Some of you listeners actually may have joined us there. We had a nice turnout, and it was a really good group. Thought it really went great. You know, we changed our hotel this year. We did them for many years at the old Flamingo on the Strip there in Vegas. And, you know, after a lot of years, it just was time, for a little bit of an update, a little bit of a change. And so we moved over to the brand new Horseshoe, which is really right across the street, which is connected to the Paris. And so, we've done a few now at the Horseshoe in the Paris, and it's just such a great facility, and the people are nice and the rooms are nice. And so it's been really good. And we had a really great, seminar there a few weeks back. What we like about that, and, you know, the grievances seminar is something that we, you know, people ask us about a lot, you know, to do more, of those things, although people tend to come more for our bargaining seminars, but, I like the grievance seminar because we get to hear from arbitrators, and we had three arbitrators who talked to us about, you know, how they view cases. And it was great. We had Walt Atrue, a really experienced arbitrator, one of the best arbitrators in the country, spoke. And then we had two newer arbitrators within the last 5 years, Cheryl Stevens out of California and Diego Pena out of Texas. And boy, those three arbitrators were so smart and so well-prepared, and you know, it just reminds me when we spend time with arbitrators, you know, how we like to make fun of arbitrators, you know, or complain about arbitrators or do any number of things in the field, on the labor and the management side. But, you know, we're really lucky to have a lot of qualified and capable people, and they were out there. And we also heard from Stu Davidson, on the grievance process. And so it was a really, really good, seminar. What were the highlights? Well, the highlights were I got yelled at, for saying Nevada instead of Nevada. So got it, learned it, all good. You're not going to hear me say Nevada again. I also learned it's more professional to describe a protester as being hit in the lower groin area with a less lethal round instead of just saying the guy got hit in the nuts. Got it, learned that. And then finally, I got to hear a great nugget of testimony from an arbitrator discussing an award that he had, involving alleged improper activities at a fire station. And here is the quote from the case. I love it. Quote, "I swear I never touched Snoopy with my penis." Close quote. That's the kind of high level discourse, right, we get at LRIS seminars. And that's why if you meet a labor lawyer or a union representative or an HR representative at a cocktail party, stay right there, right? You're going to get some really good stories about stuff that people do and say at work, you cannot make this stuff up. We try to have fun at the seminars with that stuff. We do talk about high level things and some fairly complex and difficult things, but we do like to try to keep it fun if we can and keep it interesting. Yep, never touched Snoopy with my penis. That's a good one. So we're gonna be back. If you want to go back or want to come out and see us at a seminar, we're gonna be back there in October from the 23rd to 25th, again at the Paris for our collective bargaining seminar. That one's awesome. We get experienced negotiators that just go soup to nuts on how they deal with bargaining. This year, we have Stu Davidson, who's really one of the best labor negotiators in the country on the union side. And Jonathan Downs, who is a regular speaker at LRAS events. Jonathan is a management representative, whip smart, formidable at the bargaining table. And these guys have forgotten more about bargaining than most of us know. And so we're going to spend a full day hearing from them. And then on Friday, the great Will Aitchison will be joining me to talk a little bit more about our bargaining experiences. And so that's going to be a really good one. And then in November, we're back to talk about discipline, not just police discipline. We expanded it this year to include corrections and fire. And the theme is speech privacy and off-duty conduct. And so that'll be again at the Paris, November 13th through the 15th, assuming there's not rioting on the streets in November this year. I hope that there's not. So we'd love to come out and see you. It's been a really fun fall, and there have been a lot of really interesting legal developments for us to talk about. And so come on out and see us. Okay, now let's get to the cases. We're going to start off in the great state of Ohio, the heart of it all, and in the southern part of Ohio, the city of Cincinnati, with a speech case. Two of the speech cases I told you we were going to discuss. One goes for the employee, the other goes for the employer. The one that goes for the employee is this first one out of Ohio, involving a security guard by the name of Noble. And so it's Noble versus Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library is the case. We'll include it with the materials if you want to look it up. But it was issued by the Sixth Circuit, which is a federal appellate court covering that part of the country a few weeks ago. And the Noble decision is pretty interesting because it, for me anyway, as a practitioner, it is another way of confirming what I've seen as a change in the direction of the pendulum for public employee speech cases. We track at LRAS speech cases constantly, right? And we report them out in the newsletter constantly because there's lots of them. And, if you noticed a trend in the speech cases that we report out, usually the plaintiff loses. And that's because the test that a public employee, needs to meet in order to raise a successful First Amendment speech claim against their employer, the government, is difficult. And the Supreme Court, in a case out of Los Angeles named Garcetti, gosh, almost 20 years ago now, set a test that was pretty difficult and a standard that made it very difficult for public employees to even raise claims in the first instance. And in the time since then, we've seen both a reduction in the number of First Amendment cases and cases not being decided in favor of the employee. And so I kind of thought, First Amendment stuff is really not going to be that hot anymore. And boy, was I wrong, because we've seen, I think, with the development of just social media and the frequency of people posting their views on social media, a lot of litigation, a lot of discipline of public employees, and then a lot of litigation over whether that discipline is appropriate or not under the First Amendment. We actually talked about this at our grievances seminar in Las Vegas in September, and we're going to spend a lot of time on it at our discipline seminar in November. So we'll take a deep dive into that if you have any interest in it. But basically, there's a test. If you're a public employee and you believe that you have been discriminated against because of your speech, if you've been retaliated against because of your speech, you do have some rights. Justice Douglas, I think, instructed us decades ago that public employees are not entitled to some watered down version of constitutional rights, right? Just because you wear a badge or you took an oath, it doesn't mean that you're no longer entitled to protections under the Constitution. But you know what? They are kind of watered down. If you are a public employee, the rights that you have, the protections that you have regarding the things that you say or the things that you post are not going to be the same, as if you were a private sector employee, if you didn't work for the government. And there's a test that the courts use and have used for a long time, coming out of a case by the name of Pickering. It's a education case involving some statements made by a teacher. And the Pickering test requires plaintiffs to basically meet three different prongs. So in order to raise a successful case, you have to first establish that you're speaking as a private citizen and not as a police officer or a firefighter or a correction officer or as a teacher, right? You're speaking as an individual about your own beliefs. You're not speaking on behalf of your department, right? And that's a critical distinction that, since it's the first test, that's something where employees can lose right from the jump and wind up not having a case. That was what the Garcetti case was about, out of Los Angeles. But there was a case decided by the Supreme Court in 2022, involving a football coach by the name of Kennedy. It's Kennedy v. Bremerton, that changed things a little bit. We thought that that might open the floodgates in litigation. It hasn't really done that, but it certainly indicates a change in the judiciary's thinking, we think, regarding public employees, where you draw the line between somebody's status as a private citizen and a public employee. And in Kennedy, that case involved a football coach who prayed at the 50-yard line, excuse me, after games with students, with the folks on his team and the folks on the other team. And it started out as just a nice thing, right? And that's a pretty nice thing. It's a nice thing to be a football coach and spend time with young people. And Coach Kennedy wanted to lead the young people that he coached in a lot of different ways, right? And especially how to develop into young men and women. And prayer was a big part of his life, and he wanted to share that with them. Now, he taught at a public school, right? So there might be some issues there. And what started out as just this really nice thing, as a coach kneeling at the 50-yard line and praying with students, became controversial. It got a lot of attention, and we wound up in a litigation posture. And it made it all the way up. The case made its way all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the question that the court was faced with was, when Coach Kennedy was praying with his students after football games, was he doing so as a football coach, or was he doing so as an individual? Right. And he was doing this at, I mean, his job was to coach the kids, right? He was a teacher, but his job was to coach the kids. And he was being paid. He was wearing, school hat, things like that. And given the way that cases had been decided in the previous 10 or 12 years since Garcetti, everybody assumed that, well, not everybody, but one would think that Coach Kennedy would lose. Maybe because his case involved, religious freedom. Right. And maybe when you look at the makeup of the Supreme Court and their views on religion, and some hostility toward the government, generally, you might think, well, maybe Kennedy has a fighting chance. In fact, he won. And after Kennedy, it becomes a lot more difficult for an employer defending against a First Amendment claim to argue that an employee isn't speaking as a private citizen. Now, we haven't seen many of the cases that we're worried about, right, come through. Now, I talked to you, we talked at seminars and on the podcast, and when we write, we tell you about the cases. But my personal view is, I don't want to see any of these cases, right? It would be a lot easier for everybody if people would just go to work and do their job and not have to, get on the platform and share their views, right? They wouldn't be risking their careers. But that said, people have rights. And so we've seen, since Kennedy, it seems like courts have started to be a little more liberal, towards employee First Amendment claims. And so that brings us to the Noble case out of Cincinnati. Now, The Noble case doesn't involve this first prong of the Pickering test. Are you speaking as a public employee, or are you speaking as an individual? It involves the third prong, and that's the problematic prong, right? So the first prong of the test the courts will use is, are you speaking as an individual, right? Are you speaking as a firefighter, right? That's not too terribly difficult anymore, I don't think. The more problematic prong can be the second one. What are you speaking about? Is it a matter of public concern, or is it just a gripe, a private gripe about your workplace? Again, not too terribly difficult, but you do see, cases involving that second prong. The problem is the third prong. And the third prong is balancing test. So if you can satisfy that you're speaking as a private citizen, if you can satisfy that you're speaking as a private citizen about a matter of public concern, then what the court looks at, or what the court's job is, to balance your right, your right to express yourself against any possible disruption to the public agency that you work for's ability to satisfy their mission, right? So we measure your right to speak versus the disruption, that your speech could possibly cause the employer. Balancing tests are always a nightmare, right? Some judges hate them. Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, hated balancing tests. He thought it was just an invitation for subjectivity. There's a great qu quote from one of his decisions about that, which of course I forget on a podcast, but he hated balancing tests because, really, what do you, there's nothing objective there, right? Gonna have to decide what's more important. And when I'm a judge, I'm gonna bring my life experiences and my own values to that decision, right? I'm not a computer. And that's what judges do. And so oftentimes it's really hard, to get a level of consistency in cases that are decided when you're using balancing tests, but we're stuck with them. Constitutional law is just chock full of balancing tests and chock full of, some people would say, results driven or subjective decisions. Who knows? What it really comes down to a lot of times is how good your lawyer, right? Some of the best lawyers practice in the area of constitutional law. And it reminds me of the quote of, if any of our folks are from Texas listening, the old Bum Phillips, the football coach quote, when he was talking about Don Shula and what a great coach Don Shula was. Of course, the longtime Miami, Baltimore Colt and Miami Dolphins coach. And the quote was, he can take his and beat yours, and then he can take yours and beat his. Right. So it didn't really matter who the players were. He was that good a coach that he could win either way. And constitutional law can be that way with lawyers. The right lawyer can take the same case and same lawyer represent the government, they're going to win. Take that lawyer, have him represent the employee, they're going to win, because that's where all creativity and arguing comes into play. And that's why a lot of lawyers really love that area of law. And it's why a lot of people that just have to live with the outcomes are frustrated and trying to figure out, well, what are the rules and how do we follow them? Which is why we always say, man, just stay off social media. No one really cares what you think. But hey, we have cases. So what happened with Mr. Noble? Mr. Noble is a security guard. He worked for the library system in Cincinnati. And he was fired for one Facebook post. What was the date of the Facebook post? May 26th of 2020. Was there anything interesting happening in America right around Memorial Day of 2020, right? Where some of us were stuck indoors wearing masks, other of us weren't. Florida, there was no COVID, as everybody knows. But we're in the thick of COVID. And this was the weekend that George Floyd was killed, right? And it was the beginning of, in some parts of the country, a couple of weeks of protest, and in other parts of the country, a year, of protest. And when I say protest, sometimes I mean riot. When I say riot, sometimes I mean protest. It just depends on what you're faced with, right? And so there was a big protest, started out as a protest in Cincinnati, Black Lives Matter March. The head of the library participated in the march, and lots of the library employees went to the march, right? And as is their right, and they want to express their views. And in fact, the library, I think on their Facebook page or on their website, posted a statement in support of Black Lives Matter protests and social justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Employers, remember when I said earlier, nobody cares what you think? I was talking about employees. I mean you too. Nobody cares what you think, right? And before you start taking positions on issues that don't relate to, in this instance, books, right? Maybe think about what complications that might cause in the future, because that post, that public statement, that position taken by the library on a controversial issue came back to bite him in this case. All right, so let's back up. So what happens? The boss goes to the protest. Some employees go to the protest. They, have a great experience. Mr. Noble stays at home, and he's watching TV, and he sees all kinds of craziness happening in Cincinnati and in other parts of the country, and he didn't like it. And he sees a meme, right? He didn't create the meme. No one ever creates the meme, right? Some AI bot somewhere is creating all these memes, but he sees a meme, and you may have seen it, it's all lives splatter meme, right? So, haha, Black Lives Matter, all lives splatter. And it's a stick figure meme where it says all lives splatter at the top. And then you've got some stick figures and they're getting hit by a car, right? And underneath it says, nobody cares about your protest. And so, right, people who are frustrated with protesters, and you say, oh, we have these stick figures and a car is going to hit them. Ha ha, right? Do you think that the people who posted this, or you think that Mr. Noble was advocating that people should run over and kill protesters? I think not. It just expresses an opinion that he didn't think too much of protesters. And in fact, in the case, he said he actually didn't have a problem with protesting. What he had a problem with was some of the lawlessness, associated with that, when people take it too far. The problem was he posts this on his Facebook page. He doesn't have that many followers. He's got like 50 to 100 Facebook friends, and that's all well and good. But about half of them work with him at the library. That's not unusual either, right? A lot of your friends are your Facebook friends. And so he makes this post. Only a few people see it, but a lot of them work with him. They see the meme. They show his boss isn't one of his Facebook friends. Good for him. They show the boss the meme. He goes, what the heck is going on here? This is inappropriate. And they call him in for an investigation immediately. I think the Monday or Tuesday after the weekend's protest. Now, by this time, the meme had been taken down. He took his post off of his Facebook site. Why did he do that? Because his mom yelled at him. His mom said, take that off your site. What are you talking about? Take it down. That's dumb. You could risk your job, et cetera, et cetera. And so he takes it down. It was only on his Facebook page for like 24 hours. It wasn't on that long. But of course, his boss is horrified, and some of his coworkers are horrified by what they saw. And they like this calls into question his ability to. I don't even know what, right? His ability to impartially protect the citizens of the library, right? Somehow he's not going to, I don't know what he's not going to do. But people were horrified, and in fact, they didn't really care about what he was going to do at work. They just didn't like what he posted, right? Including his boss. And so they call him in, they do an investigation, and they reach the conclusion that his Facebook post violated their harassment policy and also caused, it's a quote from the case, a loss of confidence in his ability to perform his duties impartially. So what did they do? They fired him. What did Mr. Noble do? He sued, right? He said that that action by the library violated his rights under the First Amendment. He loses in the district court. That's the first level of a lawsuit. And so he appeals that to the Sixth Circuit, which is the appellate court. The next step after Sixth Circuit is going to be Supreme Court if they take a case. So these circuit courts are significant courts. He takes his appeal up to the Sixth Circuit. There wasn't any meaningful discussion over whether he was speaking as an individual or as a security guard. The court said, you're speaking as an individual. We got that. Was he speaking about a matter of public concern? Well, yeah, right. He was speaking about, the question, is it a protest? Is it a riot? Right, what was happening around across the country at that particular time, and so the court said, of course, he was speaking about a matter of public concern. The issue, right, and it's where we always get into trouble, is this balancing test, right? And the lower court said, well, when we balance all the interests here, we find that this type of post is disruptive and it interferes with the library's mission, so Mr. Noble hasn't stated a claim. The Sixth Circuit took another view, and the Sixth Circuit said, when we're going to apply that balancing test, we think Mr. Noble wins. And interesting quote from the case, it says, there's no evidence that Noble took his politics to work, or that his views on the Black Lives Matter protests or any other political matter ever interfered with how he performed his job. The First Amendment does not permit one side of a debate to use the government to cancel the other side. Cancel, right? It allows all perspectives, even the very offensive, to be heard. Another quote, here the only injuries that resulted from the speech were the alleged wounded feelings of certain co-workers who had lost trust in Noble. Yeah, how about the beginning of that quote? There's no evidence that Noble took his politics to work or his views ever interfered with anything. We see this all the time. You'll have a police officer or a firefighter. They're going to post something, let's say something objectively offensive, right, that anybody would find offensive. But they've worked for the department for 12 years and they've done a good job, you know, or there's been no evidence that they haven't done a good job. And so how do you, you know, weigh their actual performance? It's got to count for something, right? Versus something that they did away from work and they posted. And here, in this case, with these sets of facts, which remember, pretty good facts, it was just a stick figure, you know, meme. It was only up for 24 hours. No library a user complained, right? It was a handful of coworkers that saw it. And that was about it. Those are what we call good facts for the plaintiff. When the court considered all that, you know, the court said, no, the balancing of interests favors Mr. Noble and not the library. And you know, they spoke to that a little bit. And this is something to keep in mind when we're looking at, you know, discipline matters involving employee speech, off-duty speech. And again, we'll talk about this in November in Las Vegas, but the Sixth Circuit said, quote, absent evidence that Noble posed a threat or risk to fellow workers, his hyperbolic speech alone was not enough to fire him. Given the short time Noble kept the meme on his Facebook page, its limited viewership, and the lack of public response, the library could not have reasonably expected that Noble's post would incite disruption, right? You can't just say, oh, this type of conduct is disruptive. It interferes with our mission. You have to show it. Right, you can't just make these broad allegations. You have to show it. And you know, there's another case. It reminds me of that. I don't know if we talked about it on the pod, but it was a Third Circuit. That's where I'm coming from, Pennsylvania. A Third Circuit decision involving some police officers out of the city of Philadelphia who were fired on the basis of Facebook posts that were made public as part of what was called the Plain View Project, which is some group funded by somebody, we have no idea who, that set off on a mission to get police officers fired across the country based on what they viewed as offensive Facebook posts. And they made no bones about that's what we want to do. We want to get cops fired. A lot of officers across the country lost jobs because of that. We actually handled a number of those cases. And using just cause principles have returned officers to work because of all the stuff we talked about, right? You know, what did they do at work? Were they good cops or not? Isn't that what we should be looking at? There is a lawsuit filed by some of those officers in federal court that is active. And the Third Circuit remanded the matter, which was initially dismissed because the employer said, well, these types of offensive posts, and some of the posts, if you want to take a look at the Plainview Project, they're pretty offensive. Some of them are just dumb. Most are just dumb, but some are pretty bad. That we can't have officers making posts like this, you know, and that is absolutely disruptive to our public safety operations. The court said, you can't just say that. You have to show it, right? You need evidence of actual disruption. Did any coworkers complain? Right? Did any citizens complain? What did we see this officer demonstrating in the field at the time when they were making these Facebook posts? You really have to, you know, dig into it. And so, you know, it's not just the Sixth Circuit, the Third Circuit, you know, in the Finico case decided things that way. And so it's something that we need to bear in mind. You can't, employers, you can't just say, oh gosh, this type of stuff is offensive and expect that that alone is going to get you by that third prong in a balancing test. Now, let's go to the third case because it's a little bit different. Okay, this case, our other speech case, is a recent case out of the Seventh Circuit. So it comes out of Illinois and it was decided at the end of August. Another circuit court case, right? So pretty high up there. And this involves a sheriff's department employee, an administrator who was terminated essentially for supporting the former sheriff, right, and disputes between the sheriff and the county chair, right? So we've got all kinds of political stuff going on. And listeners to this podcast know, look, that happens. We experience it from time to time. And so you have somebody who works for one sheriff who's at odds with the county commissioner, and they experience some blowback as a result. And that's what happened with Mr. Brockett. And what's interesting about this case, and the reason why we're talking about it, is a couple of things. I want to read you. This is the opening paragraph of the case. For several decades, the Supreme Court has been fine-tuning the scales that weigh a public employee's free speech rights under the First Amendment against the government's need to efficiently and effectively provide services to its citizens. Brockett's appeal of the district court's dismissal of this case might have provided an opportunity to balance these competing interests once more. Our adversarial system, however, requires parties to present us with arguments minimally demonstrating that they're entitled to relief. Without that, we have no choice but to find claims have been waived, as we do here. Oh boy. Okay, this case didn't turn out well for the plaintiff, for Mr. Brockett. And they're not just in this opening paragraph, but throughout the case, from the recitation of facts to other dicta, really, in the case, we have the Seventh Circuit telling us, you know, this is the case this guy probably would have won. We don't like these facts. We have somebody who clearly was retaliated against because of his political activity. But what happened? He didn't really argue, as to why the employer's conduct violated his First Amendment rights using the legal standards that, were set forth in Pickering and cases following that. And it's a shame because, this particular case we had an administrator who participated in the investigation and discipline of two correctional officers. For the first allegation was that they were that weren't doing checks, were signing off on checks and didn't do them. That discipline was quashed by who? By the elected official who was an enemy of the sheriff. And then there was another issue regarding more serious allegations of sexual misconduct. Again, tried to fire the two correctional officers, unable to do so because of the interference of the elected official. The elected official subsequently initiates proceedings with the state labor board to carve this administrator's position out of the bargaining unit. So then that Mr. Brockett would not have just cause protections, which they did successfully. And so apparently there was merit for that. And then they turn around and fired him, right? And so this was just a public employer methodically rewarding friends and punishing enemies and getting rid of the people that didn't toe the line. At least that's my view from the recitation of facts presented by the court. The problem identified by the court is that you can't just file something that says my rights were violated, right? I'm a public employee. I acted as a public citizen regarding a matter of public concern, and my rights outweigh the employer's rights. I mean, you can write that down on a piece of paper and file it, but there's no meat there, right? There's no there there. And that's the problem with this case. And so remember, I talked about Bum Phillips talking about Don Shula, right? He could take his and beat yours. He could take yours and beat his. The lawyers matter in these cases. And, quote from the Seventh Circuit again, Brockett does not engage with any analysis of the First Amendment issues, right? His argument consists of four sentences. I hate seeing cases like this. And you can tell the court does too. They finish the decision saying, despite our holding, we must stress that there's no magic number of words, sentences, or cases that a litigant must provide the court to defeat a motion to dismiss, right? We encourage concise and efficient briefing. But at the same time, now it's my words, you have to do something. You can't just assert that your rights were violated and not follow it up with some actual citation of cases, some development of evidence. This was a motion to dismiss, so we didn't get into discovery, but there's certainly with more support that could have been and should have been provided in the brief. And so that's the other public speech case where, gosh, we probably would have had another pro-employee decision, but we didn't. In this instance, it sounds like because the plaintiff didn't do everything that they should be doing. Okay, for the union folks listening to the podcast, what does that mean for us? I think all of this for the union folks listening to the podcast is, members have rights under the Constitution, right? And members are free to file lawsuits, and it's good for lawyers. It's good for people like me that have no other skills. But there's not always a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow. And for the union reps and the management reps involved, a nice resolution, on the front end of something, via the grievance and arbitration process, is usually going to be a much more effective tool to use to actually, achieve justice than spending lots of years and time and money on litigation. And so if that's a practice tip to take from this, is people have the right to a lawyer, but that just cause standard is pretty good. It works well for employees, and it works well for employers too when they do the right things with respect to investigations. So those are our speech cases. Okay, now the next issue is a little dicier, and it has to do with DAs, and specifically progressive DAs and immunity. The first of our two DA cases, or DA immunity cases, comes out of the state of Pennsylvania. Specifically, the city of Philadelphia. And it involves a police officer by the name of Ryan Pennell and a, I guess, so-called progressive DA by the name of Larry Krasner. Now, I know a little bit about this case, having lived in Philadelphia for the greater part of my life and having ha played a role in the grievance arbitration process that resulted in, rightly, Officer Pennell getting his job back, and he's protecting me as we speak, right? On the job for the city, and the city is richer for that. So Ryan Pennell is a police officer in the city of Philadelphia. He was terminated and criminally charged after fatally shooting David Jones in 2018. This was 3 weeks after the election of progressive district attorney Larry Krasner, a former civil rights attorney whose job basically was to sue the police department. And he ran on a platform, an anti-cop platform that included going after so-called bad cops, right? And this is a guy who had his election party. There's video of people having a good old time chanting, fuck the FOP, right? So that's the type of district attorney that we're talking about here. Doesn't feel so strongly about putting bad guys in jail. So this particular shooting, right, takes place a couple of weeks after the primary in Philadelphia, which essentially means you're going to win the general election. So Krasner has won the primary. He is the presumptive incoming district attorney. That's not going to happen for another 6 or 7 months. And he decides early on that he's going to charge Officer Pinnell with murder. First degree murder. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this. Comes right from this case. And what happened here is Officer Pinnell, at the end of a long, long struggle for justice, wound up suing the district attorney for violating his rights. This comes directly from the court. Pinnell exited his police car and approached Jones, whose bike had stalled. So this was a Officer Pinnell had stopped somebody who had been recklessly riding a dirt bike across a 12-lane highway, and he stalls out in the parking lot of this bar. So, again, back to the case. Pinnell exited his police car, approached Jones, whose bike had stalled. A struggle ensued. Pinnell grabbed Jones and felt the outline of a gun tucked into Jones's waistband. Jones broke free from Pinnell, who then drew his firearm and ordered Jones to stop resisting. Jones refused to comply. Pinnell attempted to fire his gun at Jones, but the weapon misfired. That's every cop's worst nightmare. Pinnell moved to clear the misfired round and momentarily lost sight of Jones and Jones's gun. Jones dropped or threw away the gun and started to flee. Pinnell, not realizing that Jones no longer had a gun, shot Jones. Terrence Freeman, who was riding in the back seat of Pinnell's police vehicle, witnessed the shooting. Jones was taken to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The police recovered a stolen firearm and multiple live rounds from the ground near the site of the altercation. So that's the court's recitation of the facts. I'd say that's pretty accurate. Suffice it to say, I'm not a use of force expert. I'm just a lawyer who gets to work with police officers. But this officer didn't do anything that day but his job, right? in extraordinary circumstances. And unfortunately, Mr. Jones lost his life, but it doesn't mean Mr. Pinnell did anything wrong. The DA's office investigates the shooting, right? And they're very clear, right? That they want to put this guy in jail. They investigate the shooting. They retain an expert. This comes from the decision. Gregory Warren, to prepare a report on whether Pinnell's use of force was justified. Warren concluded, the DA's expert concluded that it was, as Pinnell shot Jones because he temporarily lost visual contact while clearing the misfired rounds, and that Jones's own actions caused the shooting. Right? So the DA hires an expert, and the expert clears the officer. Okay, back to the case. Nonetheless, DA Krasner presented the case to a grand jury, withholding the expert's report until later ordered to produce it by a judge. Pinnell's criminal charges would later be dismissed, and he would also be reinstated with back pay by an arbitrator. And that's exactly what this DA did, who, by the way, his claim to fame was he was going to be the Brady DA, and he was going to make sure that we were going to, make all the Brady-io and Giglio disclosures that we can make. He must have forgotten that when it came to producing an expert report that cleared the defendant, completely exonerated the defendant, and he refused to provide that to defense counsel. So the rules don't apply if you're a police officer, apparently. Pinnell sued Krasner after he was reinstated, and he sued the city under Section 1983 for violating his Fourth and 14th Amendment rights by arresting him and prosecuting him without probable cause, right, among other things. The district court granted the DA's motion to dismiss on the basis of what? Absolute prosecutorial immunity, right? Pinnell appealed to the Third Circuit, arguing that that doesn't apply. Well, absolute immunity is a problem, right? In this case, it wound up resolving matters in DA Krasner's failure. Now, remind you, all those facts that we just took out of the case, clearly the DA did something wrong. He did something that was probably unlawful, right? That harmed this officer. And this is a guy who got impeached and all other, lots of other things regarding this DA. But he won on the issue of immunity. And why? Well, because this issue of absolute immunity is to be accorded significant deference by the courts. And so the court, noted in its decision the expansive protections of absolute immunity for prosecutors, right? As long as they're acting in their advocacy role, right, or their judicial role, if you're deciding whether to prosecute a case or not, or how to prosecute a case, pretty much you can do whatever the heck you want to do. As Mel Brooks said, it's good to be the king, right? The court cited the standard. The court cited several cases finding that prosecutors were immune from liability with regard to their conduct, finding or coinciding with grand jury proceedings. And remember here, this evidence was withheld from the grand jury. The court cited correctly another case where immunity was appropriate, where a prosecutor was afforded absolute immunity, and a case where prosecutors were accused of intentionally failing to call witnesses, right? With knowledge that those witnesses' testimony would exculpate a defendant, right? Absolute immunity covers that. The only way that Pinnell could prevail in his suit was if the DA acted not in his advocacy role, but perhaps in an investigatory role. So, where do you draw the line is really the issue that the court dealt with in this case. Now, Pinnell argued that Krasner forced this witness, right, Mr. Freeman, to change his version of events before the grand jury proceeding in order to ultimately get charges against Officer Pinnell, and that that was part of the DA's investigatory role. And so, some of the other nonsense, maybe that was part of his advocacy role or his judicial role, but getting a witness to change their story was part of the investigation role. That was an argument. And the court considered that and ultimately determined that that's not correct, and that that was not sufficient evidence of investigatory conduct. And therefore, Officer Pinnell was not able to pierce the absolute immunity afforded to a prosecutor. Now, if the facts were different, and the DA was actively involved in an investigation, and let's say, you have a high profile use of force involving a member of a police department that winds up on social media and goes all over the place and gets attention for a couple of days. And you have a political, you know, an anti-police DA someplace in the country that says, I want to prosecute that cop. And then the DA gets actively involved in the investigation. The DA runs the investigation. The DA keeps the police off to the side. Let's say it's a case involving a commander, a high profile person that the DA really wants to send a message, right, and get a head on a stake. If you push the police department aside and you conduct the investigation yourself, and then you charge and you move on from there, could you have a set of facts where the DA has not acted just in their advocacy role, but in their investigatory role? And in that set of facts, could the DA, the DA's attempt to avail themselves of absolute immunity be unsuccessful? I would suggest probably. Those are pretty specific facts. I'm thinking of a specific set of facts, and I'm thinking of a specific case where hopefully plaintiff will be successful in piercing the veil of absolute immunity. We'll have to keep you posted on that one. So that's the first DA immunity case. The DA wins, even though the facts are really bad. All right, let's talk about another case coming out of a different part of the country where the outcome was a little different. Okay, our second DA immunity case comes out of the state of Texas, comes out of the Fifth Circuit. It was decided just a few months back, and I don't know the pronunciation of the name, but I'm going to say it's Bevel versus Wheeler. And this was a lawsuit brought by a police captain, a former police captain, against the city that they work for, the mayor, state court judge, and the district attorney, alleging that those individuals there, primarily the mayor, the DA, and a judge, conspired to terminate him. What happened here in the case factually? Well, so Captain Bevel was asked to provide an affidavit in support of a motion filed by a friend of his to move his case from the county that Bevel is located in to another. And the affidavit signed by Bevel in support of the motion to transfer venue essentially alleged that his friend couldn't get a fair trial because there was a lot of publicity regarding the incident that the friend was involved in, but more troubling, that the mayor and the judge involved in the case and the DA were in cahoots and had exhibited a bias against this particular officer, and that specifically that the sheriff wanted to get this officer fired. And so the sheriff went to the DA and they cooked up charges, et cetera, et cetera. Bevel signs an affidavit to that effect, supporting his friend's version of events. And, you know, I don't know whether or not the case was transferred or not. That's not a fact in this case, because his friend is no longer the issue. Bevel's the issue. Because once Bevel puts his name to this transfer, the affidavit in support of the transfer, the venue transfer motion, that travels around like wildfire. A reporter gets a hold of it and they say there's a captain in the police department making allegations that high-ranking officials are conspiring to blah, 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 right? And what do those high-ranking officials do in response? Well, they kind of double down, right? There's evidence, you know, cited in the case, where they say, oh my gosh, did you see that what he did, what Bevel did? You know, we never liked Bevel, and I've got concerns about this. And this is the DA saying he's got significant concerns that the allegations made by Bevel in his transfer, in the affidavit in support of the transfer motion would, quote, hurt my future legal career and hurt me financially. And so what does the DA do? The DA then says, hey, you know what? There was this case that this guy was involved in, you know, a few years ago. I think it was even decades ago, where I reviewed the video of that. And I think that that Bevel's a dirty cop, you know, and I think that he actually, you know, misrepresented things in this case that we had 20 years ago. And because of that, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to call him as a witness, you know, in any cases that we have on my jurisdiction. I'm just not going to bring prosecutions because, you know, I just don't trust this particular officer, right? So we have essentially a Brady threat. He didn't name it that way, but that's what he did. The officer was fired. right? As a result of that allegation and lots of other things, okay? And the officer sues. Now, each of the individual defendants in that case raised immunity as a defense. And so the mayor and the judge attempted to raise qualified immunity defenses. The police officers listening to this podcast know what qualified immunity is. It's not absolute, okay, but there is some degree of immunity for certain government positions, given the risks involved, right, of the decision making of those individuals. This decision, I'm not talking about this decision because of the qualified immunity outcome. I'm talking about it because the DA in that case raised absolute immunity as a defense, fully expecting, right, that that's going to get him out of the case. And he was not successful. You know, initially he was successful at the district court level. The district court let some individuals out of the case, but didn't let the DA out of the case on the basis of prosecutorial immunity. The DA appealed that determination. Other defendants appealed other aspects of the district court's determination, and the circuit court got a hold of it. And the circuit court decided that the DA agreed with the district court that the DA was not entitled to prosecutorial immunity, absolute immunity. Why not? Well, before the court answered that question, they gave us a little bit of a primer on the notion of absolute prosecutorial immunity. And even though we're in a different part of the country, the rules are essentially the same, right? And so the court says we need to distinguish between the prosecutor's investigatory actions and their advocatory actions, with only the advocatory actions being cloaked with absolute immunity. So again, if the prosecutor is acting as an investigator, right, or if they're not acting directly in connection with the judicial phase of the criminal process, then they're not going to be protected by absolute immunity. Now, the basis of the DA's claim for immunity was that the argument against the DA was that basically, the DA had threatened to stop prosecuting cases involving the city of Quitman in this particular case because of the actions of this police captain, right? And the DA says, hey, I dispute that, but even if I said that I'm not going to prosecute any cases so long as this guy works for the police department, that falls squarely within my prosecutorial discretion protected by absolute immunity, right? And cites all kinds of decisions, and the court cites the decisions cited by the DA Wheeler in that case. But, and this is why facts are really important, right? The court didn't buy it, right? The court acknowledged, right, the many, many cases out there in which absolute immunity, maybe like the Pinnell case, this case predates Pinnell, but you have a DA that really was a bad actor, but they weren't bad enough, right? Or were bad enough in a different aspect of their job that they were protected by absolute immunity. You know, the court said that that is not, even though it's supposed to be absolute, it's not necessarily as absolute as the DA might think it is. And the court says, when we look at the allegations in the complaint, and this is a quote from the decision, it's difficult to see how threatening to categorically not prosecute a particular city's cases implicates the issues of witness credibility, or other things that were present in the cases that he cites, right? So when a DA is deciding whether to prosecute or not, that involves some exercise of judgment and looking at witness credibility and all those types of things. The DAs say that we should not be second-guessed on that, and courts are going to, you know, side with them on those issues. This court in the Bevel case says that this doesn't involve that. This is just you saying, I'm not going to prosecute any case associated with this city so long as this guy works there. There's no discretion, right? You're not assessing anything, right? You're just threatening something. And the court cites, there are some cases out there where limitations on absolute immunity were set up. And the court cites a case where a prosecutor, coupled a threat of prosecution with demands for bribes, right? Okay, if you don't give me X, I'm going to prosecute you. Or where prosecutor, you know, used the threat of prosecution to secure sexual favors. You can't do that and just say, well, it's part of my judicial, you know, responsibility. And so I have absolute immunity for that. And so, you know, the court noted that A prosecutor can't couple a threat of a prosecutorial decision with a demand that a certain condition be met. Certainly, if you've acted without any kind of colorable claim of authority to impose the condition. And when the court took that standard and applied that to the case involving this particular police captain, the court said that absolute immunity did not apply. And to quote from the decision, absolute immunity does not cover the DA's alleged act of wielding his prosecutorial authority as a threat to influence a public employment decision over which he had no lawful authority. Such a threat cannot reasonably be considered intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process. We agree with the district court that DA Wheeler is not shielded by absolute prosecutorial immunity. Now, wait a minute here. That's interesting because let's go back and listen to this one again. The alleged act of wielding his prosecutorial authority is a threat to influence a public employment decision over which he had no lawful authority. What's the decision that he wanted to influence? Getting a cop fired. And so we have a court decision, you know, noting that, you know, when a DA says, if you don't fire this guy, right, I'm not going to prosecute any cases, right? That could potentially be, and in this case, it was something that's not going to be protected by prosecutorial immunity. I'll tell you, as somebody who gets faced, you know, all the time with questions regarding Brady and Giglio issues and DAs placing officers on Brady lists, or DAs, especially progressive DAs, going further where they don't really care, where the sense is that they don't necessarily care about the Brady or Giglio rights of defendants. What they really want to do is get an officer fired and use Brady as a sword, right, to eliminate departments of officers that the DA, for whatever reason, may deem as a bad cop. The decision, you know, that we've just talked about, I think, could be used in cases challenging those things to say, okay, when DAs attempt to use Brady as a weapon and get involved in the employment decision as to whether or not somebody continues to work for a department, then they're going to risk losing that really valuable shield of absolute immunity. So this is one decision, right? But, you know, we see them every once in a while, and it's the different side of the Pinel coin. You know, in that particular case, the DA didn't say, if you don't fire this police officer, right, I'm going to blank, right? In fact, this police officer had already been fired, you know, before the DA brought criminal charges. But it's a little, you know, chink in the armor, I think, of absolute prosecutorial immunity, which is why we're talking about it. Okay, so there you have it. Four cases, two speech cases, two DA cases, two wins for the plaintiffs, and two wins for the defendants. How fair and balanced and reasonable is that? We hope you thought it was interesting. And if you want to get into a deeper dive of those cases or just the issues, right, speech rights, Brady and Giglio rights, we are going to spend 2.5 days on that this November from the 13th to 15th at our Best Practices and Discipline seminar. If you want to know a little bit more about Gary rights or Brady rights, keep an eye out. We're going to be doing webinars on those particular issues as we move forward. So thanks a lot for listening, everybody, and I look forward to talking to you again in November.